Welcome to Myanmar in a Podshell, the podcast that puts current developments in Myanmar into context. My name is Rodan Ebbinghausen, and today we want to talk about peace and ask the question, what are the chances, what are the obstacles to peace for Myanmar? So we are going to discuss these questions with two guests, Anne Baer, who is an anthropologist, peace and conflict consultant, and systemic therapist. She works since almost 20 years in the field of conflict transformation and peace work, internationally as well as in Germany. She is mainly exploring the question, how can we preserve and restore peace, and which inner and outer capacities do we need to do so? And our second guest is Yetet, who is an activist and trainer in nonviolence activism. He works for Freedom Fighter Myanmar, an organization dedicated to grassroots and civic movements through education and dialogue facilitation. So thank you very much for joining us today. And so let's start with the discussion. I would like to ask first Yetet, as you are being from Myanmar. Myanmar is currently facing a new phase of civil war with atrocities being reported across various parts of the country. More armed groups have emerged, and for many, armed struggle seems to become a new way or a way of life. So conversations about peace are rare. And from your perspective, how important is it to think and to talk about peace in such a context?
Right now, I think Myanmar's situation is very difficult and also very painful to see. Well, Myanmar is the country with the longest ongoing civil war in the world. But right now, the violence is more intense. Some data say like at least 50,000 people has been died in the armed conflicts after the coup, after 2021 military coup. So it's like more than a person die an hour, every hours. So right now, yeah, like as you said, armed resistance is like new way of living. And also people, a lot of people think only by fighting we can achieve peace. So peace only come after winning the war. So this is the common narrative, like how people think these days. But I think we need to be really careful this time, because without thinking about how to achieve peace, it is really difficult. We don't even know how can new peace can come. I think thank you for arranging this podcast, because this is a topic we need, because I think people would say the war, the aim of the war is to achieve peace. So I think we should discuss about what are the barriers and how to achieve peace.
And maybe with your experience also from other conflicts, how easily, in a way, gets peace out of sight in the armed struggle? And how important is it to always think about it or to be remembered that this is overall the aim? What would you say?
From my experience, it is that peace is what Yetet said, it's at the end of the war. But it's much more than that. Talking really about peace and how to attain like a trustful environment and a respectful and a really peaceful environment is a very difficult thing to discuss in open conflict. Because as Yetet said, the suffering is so immense and the pressure is so immense. But yet, peace movement and the idea to come to peace also through different means than armed struggle is always, I think, a most important voice within each and every conflict. And this is why I feel like the discussion of peace should never end. It should never be stopped. Although, and this is also what I experience, there are situations where it's labeled to be naive or not important at that moment. But I think it always is.
So you just said that sometimes people say it's naive or it's not the right time to talk about peace. Mm-hmm. But maybe we can say, or I would like to talk a little bit about, what does peace actually mean? Is it just the silence of the weapons, or is it something different? Mm-hmm. Is it more than just no fighting? Or the absence of fighting? I would like to give this question to both of you, but maybe Anne, you can start. What is peace?
I would like to answer from different angles. When I look at in the international conflict work, we are mostly using the example of Galtung, Johann Galtung, where we talk about the triangle of violence and labeling peace in the negative peace in the absence of actual violence, violent behavior. But what we are aiming for at peace work is the so-called positive peace, which include the absence of two other forms of violence. It's a structural and a cultural violence, which are much more deeply rooted in society and in the conflict dynamics. It is also something which we have not ever seen yet on Earth. As structural violence, for example, it's any kind of poverty is labeled structural violence. We haven't seen a world of equality and respect for everybody. And the cultural violence, it's also rooted in the narratives. How are we talking about each other? What are we saying? What are we thinking even? So what world are we creating? So this is, for me, peace is something that we yet need to explore. We have experienced it on different levels. So the weapons are silent and we are in a position to restructure and to rethink. But I'm always holding it in a bigger space to make it even something we have to aim for, to long for. It's a very powerful path if you embark on this peace journey. This is from my perspective.
I think it's very interesting to talk about that violence is not only about arms or fighting, that it is also like the structural and the cultural aspect. So maybe Yetet, as you are from Myanmar and you know Myanmar better, what would you think about these three areas? So I think that we can agree that there is structural violence in Myanmar. There has always been cultural violence. And of course, we see the armed struggle. So what is your experience with Myanmar in relation to peace? Like, what is the specific case or the problem or the challenge for Myanmar related to peace from your perspective?
It's a very good question, I think. I'm studying especially about non-violence. So like how Anna explained about peace with positive and negative peace with like cultural and structural violence. I think, first of all, I think peace is, it's a very ideal term. It's very relative, I would say. It's not, there is no absolute peace because every community, every society is struggling in its own way. There are different forms of violence, not just about arm. There are different forms of control, oppression, exploitation, many ways. And about Myanmar, yes, I think people will say this right now, this conflict is about the military coup and it's because of the military and military leaders and because of that. But I would say that could be a part of the conflicts, but more or less, it's more like the coup and the current conflict is more of a symptom, I would say, of the root cause, underlying pain, underlying trauma, underlying injustice, underlying violence in Myanmar. So, yeah, so to achieve peace, I think it's a long way. It might be never. I think it's like an infinite gain process. You got to always continue finding to have a more peaceful society. But at the same time, to do that, I think we need to really understand and also to solve the underlying issue, not just the, of course, military is an important part, but we got to also see beyond that military, I think, the cultural and structural aspect of it.
You said that the coup is only a symptom of a deeper cause, but can you help us understanding what you think is this deeper cause in the case of Myanmar?
It's difficult. I got to say it like one thing only. Many things are mixing right now, I would say. But yeah, I can point out a few. So first of all, I think the legacy of colonialism will be one. In such that, so like the current Myanmar, the border, the territory, the system is made by British. That's, I would say it's kind of a fact. But, well, like Myanmar people, because of the nationalist movement, especially the Burmese majority, thinking that they cannot give the credit to British because they want to give the pride, like this country is built by their own. But indeed, before the British colonization, it was just small groups scattering. Of course, at some point, the Myanmar people take over other ethnic groups, like like vice-versa. But the thing that make this consolidation of power and this formation of state is made by the British. But for Burma people, it's really hard to accept this truth. So they create many story like this is made by Myanmar kingdom. It's like, so the first, second, third kingdom, these great kings make this country. So they always use this military rule with this strong power to unite this country. So this is like a very strong propaganda, I would say. Even lots of people want democracy, but this propaganda is still, I think, influencing largely the Myanmar society. So like Myanmar people thinking like we got to be strong, we got to be unite with strong power. So that our, like, there's so many in Myanmar, like, textbook, like, history textbook. We are very proud of this big territory. Like, Myanmar, once a time, we conquered Thailand, we conquered India. Like, this big empire coming because of the strong kings. So this kind of story, I think it's a primary part of the historical injustice. Well, it's combining the, what's empowering Myanmar, like, especially Burmese nationalism, I would say, is Buddhism, I would say. So Buddhism, it's a long story, but I would say Buddhism is also, it's not just a spiritual practice or it's not just a religion, it's more, it's a identity, it's the most powerful political philosophy, I would say, cultural philosophy in Myanmar. So, you know, like, these are like, the Burmese can always use, even military also using Buddhism as a legitimizing power. So like, these are always, these, you know, we can debug in many ways, but I think this nationalism and Buddhism combination is the strongest power coming from this colonial, like post-colonial states. So like, I think we can think from many angles, but this could be a powerful one, I think, yeah.
Okay, so thank you. So I would try to now switch a little bit to like, we know the problem or we know some of the problems we have. So what is like, how can we turn this into a positive way to get out of the trap, if you may say so, yeah, like how to overcome these challenges? And I would like to also know from Anna, as you have been working in different conflict scenarios, basically how do you get out of this, I don't know, cycles of violence, out of this narratives of cultural or structural violence or dominance? How do you get out of this?
Yeah, if I really would know that, that would be a fantastic thing. But I have a few ideas about it and experiences. One thing that I experience everywhere, and I think it's very important also to differentiate from the beginning, there's always an inner process, like an inner person process and the outer process, which are different and intertwined at the same point. But from my perspective is if the whole energy, like the whole goal is to create peace, to leave this conflict behind, that is a very, very strong decision to take within each and everybody of us, but also in a conflict scenario. So on a bigger conflict scenario, if it's too painful for all parties involved, this could be a turning point. But it's like straightening your intention towards peace and really saying we want that. And then on a very concrete level, say, okay, what does it mean to that particular conflict? So what would we need to do in this community to go on a different path? How do we need to deal with, for example, history, what you said, Yitit? It's a huge topic. And what do we need to solve? Maybe what do we need to resolve? Maybe there are things we need to leave behind in order to move forward. Because peace, it's not in the past, it's something we create here for the future. So that is very important to see. And sometimes the past, as painful as it might be, maybe it needs resolution, something people cannot even think of. And this is, for me, it's the driving force of leaving conflict.
If I got you right, you would say there is a kind of a pain peak, if I may say so, and then there is a turning point and people think we cannot continue like this. We have to follow another path. If I got you right, so the question is, we can only start this piecework if we somehow reach this turning point where people really want to change. And I would like to ask Yitet, do you think that this turning point has been reached yet in Myanmar?
I doubt that, I would say. I doubt the idea that there will be a pain peak, like the theory said in Myanmar case. Because in the past, I mean, the community leader, the mobilizer, the political leader, and the community is kind of linking together, at least physically and in many ways, they are in the community. Right now, it's the mobilization mainly coming through social media, especially on Facebook. And yeah, I think for some community, the pain is already reached. Like, for example, for some area, part of the world who are really facing the conflicts, of course, the people are really facing the pain, so they want to stop the war. But the driver, the engine of this movement currently are mainly mobilizing through, they are like more like a elite community or like more like a middle layer community. So like they are in the social media and a lot of them are in the safe place, I would say. The diaspora or like a community. The pain, I mean, the shared pain is, I think, quite limited, I would say, right now. So that's why I want to challenge this concept of like the pain peak, because in media, in social media, people will always, there's a double life, a double reality, double world there.
I think it's a very important point that you are touching it by saying that we have so many different actors also in the war. Even if it's on the civil society, it's a totally different scenario from the leading point of view. And that is so crucial. And maybe I would also turn it around, like not talking about a pain peak, but there's a, I would say it's a longing. It more that something shifts. And it's especially, I think, as you're also working in the civil movement and in civil society. So it's a rethinking of, are we walking the right path? Is this how we are going to build up our country? This is the way we are. And it works independent from what the leading people, the leaders say. They might have a totally different agenda. And it's very often if like the nonviolent movement coming from the civil society, normally it's not matching what it's intended from the government. But it's still strong. And these dynamics, they can start by like people diverting their, like turning around and seeing, whoa, there are different options. And that is a very important and interesting point. And I said the influence of social media, I think it's so enormous and yet to be understood fully how it's used and how also the civil society can use it to the benefit.
But as you, Anna, just mentioned, there needs to be like to a turnaround or to think about there are options, because at the moment it seems like everybody is just going for one goal. Yeah, like it's the armed struggle, it's the win over the military. But I would like to ask also Yetet, are there maybe traditional or historical examples from Myanmar or ethnic groups who could serve as a role model?
I think from nonviolence tradition, like there are many, but I can tell two. One is like the famous Aung San Suu Kyi, of course, the fear and non-fear, her approach is focused more about internal change, ideological shift rather than destroying the other part. So this is a way of peace building, I would say. Another person would be a famous writer called De Gong Taye. Also, his life code is about there is no enemy, there's always friends. So the aims of politics is to make more friends. So these kinds of thinkers are there.
My experience in Myanmar is that in Myanmar society and culture, there is a relatively strong belief in something which you can say like, let bygones be bygones. And it's related to the Buddhist concept of impermanence. So on the other hand, we have this very strong call for accountability and justice. And I would also say punishment, which is also from international NGOs. Like we have to make the generals pay. And I would like to know like, which of these two approaches, which one would say like, let bygones be bygones, or we have to have the strong accountability, we have to have a punishment, and so on. Which of these two would you say are more helpful or are needed for a transition to peace?
It depends on what kind of world you want to create afterwards. How does Myanmar look like when it starts anew? And from there, you learn from the existing concepts. You could not apply, just say, okay, we do this one or we do this one. From my perspective, if one would really perfectly work, it would have already worked. So we have to think afresh and anew and maybe combine. But I think a certain way of justice is a huge topic, for example. How do we achieve justice? What do we need to do that? There are so many international examples how it's done, and it's done in various ways and normally rooted in the cultural background and appropriate to the cultural background. And it's also a Buddhist tradition. You cannot just say we don't think about it because it's present. It's very important. So I would always use this concept because a concept is only a concept, and you use it to form what makes sense, what makes total sense in this moment, and be open and free. And this is also what I think. It's a very important part. People resolving conflicts, they need to have the freedom to find their own path and to really develop a vision of where are we going to and what do we need in order to reach this point.
Before discussing about this justice, I'd like to discuss a little bit about Myanmar culture, the cultural barriers or the cultural contradictions. You know, like what's Myanmar means? Like, it's interesting sometimes to think, because Myan in Burmese, it's mean quick. It's mean like fast. It's kind of like, yeah. And then Mar mean it's kind of hot. It's strong. It's kind of stubborn, you know, these kinds of words, like marming, you know, strong. So the combinations of these words is like, in a way, it's very relevant to Myanmar culture, I would say. So Myanmar is always proud of being strong, being, in a way, masculine, I would say. We always proud that we don't bow easily. And like Thailand always like compromise and flexible and adaptable to other conditions. But Myanmar always strong by our own. So we are always proud. This is how identity building of Myanmar. So, and also we want very quick results. Military also think after making the coup, we can change the country, we can change the system. The opposition also think like, you know, every motivation on Facebook is about we will win very soon. So from both sides, always thinking, this is from the beginning, like from like 2021, still now, always thinking about this. We want to make something very quick action. So did this make really difficult to sometimes think about peace or also justice, I think, because the way toward peace and justice also needs a very, sometimes very gentle approach, need to consider different perspective altogether. Yeah, so about the justice, yeah, like people always criticize, like especially the Buddhists giving to the aggressor. That's why the cycles of violence is happening again and again. But I think for me, yeah, it's not for me to decide. It needs a long process of dialogue to consider what kinds of justice serve Myanmar people. But my idea, there's some idea and recommendation there. I would say it depends. We cannot just, like right now, the transitional justice, there are lots of activists saying about we should not give no more pardon to any forms of injustice. But I think justice, I think it's not about being just fair. And the fairness is really hard to attain in many cases. Like, people already die and you cannot make people live again. So we got to really think about what's the purpose of justice. I think the purpose of justice is to take a lesson and to heal from all the participants of this act, either the oppressor or the victims or perpetrator or the community. We got to think about how to heal and how to take lesson from the events. So with that approach, I think there are many creative ways, many different ways we can think of. Right now, one thing that I feel difficult at some time, and also I think impractical at some point, is like a lot of activists and lots of like organization, also I think international government also pushing this transitional justice too hard, I think. And what happened, I feel like, is like there are lots of training about you got to take reports, you got to take documentation so that after winning the war, you can find the justice. So people are just waiting the war and also collecting the documents. And I think the pain and trauma is expanding. There is no way to heal right now. not anything can be do right now. You can just wait for the war is done, and there will be like some kinds of UN or like IEEE 1 will make your case justice. So this kinds of thing is in a way dangerous, I think, because it's kind of cut off the local agency. And also just wait, like some people will solve. Like we cannot do anything about this justice. So this is, I think, not that productive, I think. So we can start dialogue about justice right now. We can talk how to heal, how to resolve. So I think the idea of restorative justice would be a good one to consider about the Burmese culture, because in Burmese also, in Buddhism, Buddha never disconnect or think about punishment. Rather, Buddha always think about how to change a person, how to heal. So whether you are a person killing your father or whether you're a person killing like 100 people randomly, he would try to communicate, he tried to educate. So this is the approach, because in Buddhism, its aim is about the change rather than punishment. So I think there are something we can learn. Like Buddhism also saying not about forgetting everything. Yeah, like in Burmese culture, it's different. In Burmese culture, it's about waiting. Like you got to wait. You got to wait that perpetrator was served by its own karma. So like in a way, it's a form of hatred, internal hatred. You hate the person, but you cannot do anything. But you hate that person was destroyed by itself. So this is kind of waiting. The current Burmese culture is not that helpful. But if we try to find some way and also to connect with the restorative justice approach, I think Burmese and also a Buddhist culture can think of a new form of justice.
So this brings me to my next question. I would like to, maybe Anna first, like, is peace possible without reconciliation and forgiveness? Because I want to make it concrete. So at the moment, for me at least, it is very hard to imagine, let's say, an SAC officer shaking hands with a PDF fighter from Chin State, where the fighting is very fierce. But isn't this basically that to achieve peace at some point, we have to reach this possibility or this imagination that it has to be possible? Or am I wrong here?
No, that is definitely a point where this needs to happen. I think it's very helpful to look at ourselves. How do we end conflicts? How do we end harsh conflicts that we're having? What is needed? And looking at the internal processes, it's very important to say, how do I do it? Very, very specifically, this is how I do my peace work, like really looking into it. What's your personal skill and what is needed? What capacity do you need to build up? And you mentioned the term of healing. The healing, I think it's such an important point because it's different also to justice. To me, let me go back a little bit, because it's like, why do you do justice? To implement something that you call justice or to come back to peace? And if you come back, the aim, the overall aim is peace. And if you have like a peace grid that you lay over everything you do, whatever you do, this is where you want to go. This is where you want to end up. You might do totally different things. Also, when it comes to justice, maybe the international community would say now it needs to be like a court, blah, 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 blah. But Myanmar people would say, no, we're doing it in this way because it leads us to where we want to go. So that's opening and rethinking things. This is one thing that I find very intrinsic in peace work. You need to allow yourself to think different thoughts, not only out of the box, but to allow yourself also to dream. And to imagine things where other people would say, that's not possible. Because people who really are our examples in peace work, they had this inner capacity to do so, to stand it, to stand for their beliefs and dreams. And forgiveness is one of it. And reconciliation, it seems almost impossible. How can this happen? Actually, it's also a decision taken. And for me, there are different steps. Forgiveness, I can forgive. I can do this by myself. I don't need anybody to forgive. It's an inner process. And it's just detangles myself from this binding of conflict. For reconciliation, I would need another person. I need somebody who would agree to meet. If I am fighting and the other person says, no, I'm not, there's no point of doing it. So it needs a different development and the openness to really say, now we want to sit. and our aim is peace. So it's a very deep commitment. And I will always believe in it. I know it's possible, and it's needed. It's needed to really end conflicts. Because this is my experience. Conflicts can come to an end, but they are still latent. If the reconciliation, especially in the communities, and it ends with the individual, it's not finished. There's always this spark that can come up again. And it's a long, long process, and it's a very individual process. But I think it's at the end, if we really want to come to peace, then it's the path to go, step by step by step.
I would like to pick up this two things like forgiveness and reconciliation and talk a little bit more about forgiveness. You said it's an inner process, mainly. I can do it with myself because I have to decide to forgive. But I would like to talk a little bit about the environment, which makes it maybe easier or more difficult. And my impression at the moment in Myanmar, I don't speak Bama, but what I get from the English language social media and what I hear from people who speak Myanmar, that there is the idea of forgiveness is sometimes even seen as being treason. And I would like to know, like, how can this be changed that forgiveness is not like kind of treason? That it is like really a constructive thing which might lead to healing and there is no a way around it.
It's like some people think if I forgive, everything is forgotten. That's not true. Forgiveness can also lead to trials and whatever, but it puts you in a different place. You're not acting from a place of violence, but from a different inner and outer place. And I think this is something that you think, like, if I forgive, whatever you did, it's fine. That's not. There need to be a process afterwards. And this is a very important point. But nevertheless, forgiveness is, for me, it's crucial.
What do you think, Yedhit, about forgiveness?
Yeah, if I say we should forgive, then people will think me as like a military defender, like someone like military paying me to talk to me, like a lobbyist for military. So the terms like forgive is quite, I think, in a way, kind of misleading in Myanmar context. It's a complex word, I would say. It's including many different aspects, but I'll try to simple it down. First of all, I think it will be difficult to forgive once seeing the continuous aggressions and repressions of military and then the violence. And also there's a long process, I would say, rather than whether we should forgive or it's not just a binary option. It's a long process of healing. And also, like Anna said, it's not about forgiving the military. It's about how to heal and how to compassionate ourselves. I think that would be like better framing. The problem with Myanmar is like, when we cannot solve the violence, when we cannot solve the pain, that trauma become replicate, reproduce, and transfer within the community. So like when there is an oppression, there is always a like action and reaction there. So like Myanmar military doing oppression, there'll be people resisting. Myanmar military doing lots of Burmanizations and influence to ethnic tribe will do resistance. So this cycle will always continue unless we find a way to break it out. And the only way to break it out, I think, is like to shift the perspective of absolute terms. Like right now, people thinking like, okay, every problem's coming from military. Therefore, we don't have any other choice than destroying the military first, and then we can think other thing later. So this is the current approach thinking. This is like military is the pure black, and then the revolutionary sides are pure white. So this is kind of this black and white thinking. It's a way difficult to think about peace. This mentality need to change first, because if we think everything has happened due to military, then we don't have any form of accountability. We don't need to take any agency. We don't have any forms of agency or accountability to take part in the process. I think at one point we got to think about how to change the military. But at the same time, I think we got to think about what changes need to do by ourselves also. So I on that sense, yeah, like ethnic communities or like Myanmar community as a whole facing a lot of pain and struggle. But at the same time, at some point, we are also part of the system, part of the systems of this violence machines, violent system. So we got to think of like how to understand our pain and at the same time, how to move forward. I think that would be better. Yeah.
If you would think about, okay, in the current situation in Myanmar, what could be a first step, like only a first step on this long path to peace, or reconciliation and even forgiveness?
It's a difficult question, because it cannot be said like it's like this is always happening, because it sounds like a recipe that we could do, but with the, which we can't. But at the end, and my perspective is from the civil movement. So I wouldn't say the leaders need to change and then that's the first step. But I know that peace spreads. That is a very interesting thing about peace, because it's very inspiring. It's a very inspiring process. So I think whatever grassroots organization, and there are in Myanmar, there are many, hold on to nonviolence and hold on to a different approach to peace. And I think what we also had, like, it asks for a lot of courage at the moment to voice things. As you said, if I say that, I would be labeled and stuff. And that is true. It's the truth. And it asks for a fine sense of what is possible for me, using a lot of courage. But I would say what I see, if there are communities who are, like it's a book called from CDA, like opting out of war. If there's a group of people or a community who really finds a way to install a system of peace within their community, and it's happening more and more, this is always, to me, like a cell. And it's not the only thing. There need to be, we always work on different levels in peace work. That's not the, I say, if we do this, then we need to work with the governments and with the legal system and trauma work. And there are so many approaches. But building, really practicing peace, even if it's very small, because what I think is peace is always there where people live it.
There are organizations like Western or international organizations, and there is, for example, the Weltfriedensdienst or Ziviler Friedensdienst. How do you think they can facilitate this or support this, and are they good at doing it?
Oh, now you're asking me something, because I've worked in the Civil Peace Service for a long time myself, and even with the World Peace Service. So, partly. Maybe then can create a container where people really are able to find ideas. I think peace is always developed within and with the people on the ground. And sometimes it's good to have an outside view for analysis, for example, or if also providing money. But the actual peace, and it's never brought. We cannot bring something or say like, "Ooh, it's something." If somebody comes to my house and says, "Oh, now I bring peace, and maybe you do this and that," it will not work. So I think if the international community can have a role, it's more in a facilitating way, a facilitating space, making space for people to meet, maybe, and offering knowledge when it's asked for.
Thank you very much. So coming back to the last question, what would be a first step you think yet can be walked or done in Myanmar to go on this important travel towards peace?
Yeah, as I said, it's a complex one. It needs a lot of components to think. But I can think a few. I think, first of all, it's like we need to use some of the cultural aspect. I think Buddhism would be an important one, I think. Especially the Buddhism idea is framed about the middle way. It says like you got to have the right view and you got to have the moderate actions. So this is the ideas of Buddhism towards peace. And then I think this practice needs to be developed in the politics and also in the struggle. Right now, I feel like the current Myanmar struggle is more like a kind of like a radical action, like radical mobilization, but very little visions of clear view about the future. So we need to advance that. We need to have more thinking about a clear view and more radical version of the future. But we need to think about how to create this with a step-by-step approach or like in a moderate approach. That would be, it will be difficult, but this kind of long-term moderate approach would be a better self, I think, to Myanmar people. And then I think the essential ingredient would be dialogue. Here, dialogue is not just, what I mean dialogue is not just about talking and like thing, because international community also see a lot of dialogues. Like this is like a keyword, every time you need dialogue. But I feel like even international community cannot practice dialogue, because at some point they use, because Myanmar people already facing this enormous inferiority complex already. And there are lots of people working with international community to get the help. Like Myanmar people are most of the time receiver arm. So like there are always the power difference there. So when the like people from the international community say Myanmar people need to accept and agree on that room, but when they move out, they say these people don't understand us. So this kinds of double reality is happening and it's not helpful, especially like dialogue, non-violence, these kinds of idea international community try to impose into Myanmar community, and Myanmar community saying like they got to smile at the meeting room, but when they move out, they say like that doesn't relevant to Myanmar context. So there's a great gap about this power difference and dialogue facilitation, even in the practice of the community itself. So like, I mean, I am just trying to highlight that because this podcast is mainly about international community, but the same goes on the other part of the community. This, it's really like when you say dialogue, people think about like NUG meeting with SAC and making this dialogue meeting. No, like dialogue mean like we can, most of the time dialogue happen with someone in the close proximity, like with our friends, with our community. We start talking because we cannot start talking with the enemy. We got to start talking with our community, thinking about our pain and also our hope for the future so that our pain will be healed and also our kind of new visions will become up. So this dialogue is gentle and really hard to, right now, I think it's more than necessary right now, because if you can see the armed resistance is going momentum, but there is no dialogue or political progress in current resistance. And yeah, I think the last thing would be the component of truth, I would say. After all, how to heal the trauma, how to move forward, how to relieve from the past, it's all come from the truth, I think. And right now, I think the truth is hard to find because like it's more about propaganda, it's more about massive noise and information. So it's really hard to right now even discuss, even between the like pro-democratic actors. That's quite challenging, I would say. This is like a times of post-truth, I would say. So like to find truth, we need to a little bit slow it down. We need to think, we need to reflect. Otherwise, if we just like over-excited, over-sensationalized, over-confidence about and focusing on shorthand only, it will be hard to achieve peace.
Yeah, when you're talking about truth, it's so interesting because I feel like it's also something that I can claim. Who has the truth? It's immediately linked back to power and to violence in that point. So for me, like truth finding, it's how to find truth. But I can listen to your truth and to really listen and trying to understand what is your truth. And I can share mine. And then from this point where I know I'm not judged for my truth, even if it's totally out of control or you feel like, what's she talking? But there need to be a space where I can voice it because it's my inner concept and I need to lay it out and you might respond to it. And then this is also a form of dialogue where we really dare to speak out and also to listen what others are saying, even if it's very contrary to what we think. And from this point of understanding or the willingness to understand, now I understand how you perceive that. Never thought of it. From there, we can start finding out what it's really all about. Not aiming to have like, because my inner truth and how I view the world will always differentiate from yours, but we will have enough in common to live in peace. And this is something, and this is really the long, long process. But I think in every discussion or where we go, it's like even here today, like, are we here to really listen and to understand each other and to see this curiosity within us, to really understand? And to me, it's a very crucial thing for peace building to carry that willingness and also being brave enough to say what you really believe.
So thank you very much for sharing your thoughts and insights about peace and peace in Myanmar. And I think it's not wrong if I say that it all starts with an inner shift of attitude, of that peace starts within ourselves and that we have to start to listen, to understand, and to open up and maybe to get rid of this entanglement in the daily struggle and the daily fighting, and to find a connection to ourselves and shift inside. So this was very interesting. And To our listeners, I would like to thank you for listening to Myanmar in a Podshell. Please tune in again next time. Have a good day. Thank you very much.